This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast focuses on the opioid issue and pain management in post-acute and long-term care settings. The healthcare community is well aware of this country's current crisis around the management of pain and opioid abuse. According to a June 2018 publication by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, opioids were the cause of death in 42,000 people in 2016. 40% of all opioid overdoses involved a prescription. 11.5 million people misused prescription opioids, and over 2 million people suffered from opioid use disorder. Although CMS is actively engaged in prevention of overprescribing patterns, alternative treatment strategies, and access to data in order to monitor effectiveness of treatments, when the question arises on how best to use opioids in the management of arthritic, cancer, neurologic, or other chronic illness pain in elders, a 2017 Kaiser Health News report concluded, it's a balancing act. In a 2015 Annals of Long-Term Care article entitled, Pain Management in Long-Term Care Communities, a Quality Improvement Initiative, the authors discussed that 45 to 80% of older adults in long-term care experience significant chronic pain, yet pain remains under-recognized and under-treated, impairs overall quality of life, and further burdens healthcare resources. And authors Farless and Ritchie, in a 2012 article entitled Challenges of Pain Management in Long-Term Care, included other barriers to effective management of pain, including high staff turnover, regulatory issues, lack of staff education, cognitive impairment, and underreporting by patients, often with difficulty in quantifying or qualifying pain. How can we reconcile the opioid crisis and drivers to reduce opiate use with the needs of a pained, aging population and the unique setting of long-term care? How can we, Joe AMDAs in the trenches, make smart choices about pain management strategies? Obviously, we are already addressing pain issues, but are we on the correct path for the highest caliber of quality care? To help us think about the nuances of the issue of pain management today in long-term care, we've asked Dr. Jeff Nichols to join the discussion. Dr. Nichols is a geriatrician and hospice and palliative care practitioner. He is chief medical officer of Gouverneur Skilled Nursing Facility in New York City. He is a clinical associate professor of geriatrics at NYU Langone Medical School. And he has a regular column in Caring for the Ages called Ask Dr. Jeff. Dr. Nichols, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
Dr. Nichols, AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, as well as the American Geriatric Society, has created guidelines for pain management in elders. We know that 1/4 of all deaths occur in the nursing home setting. We know that long-term care residents have complex medical histories, and we know that they have pain. When we talk about the opioid crisis and concerns about managing chronic pain today, are we talking about the long-term care resident too?
We're certainly talking about the long-term care patient, many of the patients we're seeing regularly in our nursing home. And we could be seeing a variety of different patients within that setting as well. Because anyone who's ever done a home visit knows that every older adult has pain medicine in their medicine cabinet, if not directly on their dining room table, because many of the aches and pains of aging simply are commonplace and relatively expected in our population, yet frequently do not get treated in the nursing home setting because of various barriers that exist within our world. One obviously is that many of our patients are cognitively impaired and can't ask for the medicines that they need. They are not allowed to take medicine on a regular basis on their own. As needed medicines, particularly pain medicines, are not always a top priority for our nursing staff, even when people request them. So many patients who you might say have pain medicine available for them are not really receiving it, to the point that many people have said that the initials PRN stands for patient receives none. So you've got a whole set of patients who are in that category, many of whom were people who, when they were at home, would have always taken something before they went to bed at night, because we know that pain from osteoarthritis tends to be worse in the evening and often at bedtime, and that simply it's a big help going to sleep. In our setting, all too often, that same group of people wind up getting a sleeping pill instead, which is obviously an inferior approach to that. Pain is unfortunately, as I've been aging and discovering, sort of a reality for the aging process. But for most of those pains are relatively minor, but they still can interfere with quality of life in very significant ways, having to do with mobility, appetite, sleep, many of the major things that we try to address in long-term care. There also are a whole group of people who very much have pains related to end-of-life considerations, many of whom are experiencing much more severe pain. And unfortunately, many of those patients are also not having their pain adequately addressed. So, there's awareness that other medications exist, but in many cases still significant underuse of available opioids for control of some of those severe pains.
So as geriatricians, we know that elders represent a unique segment of the adult population. We understand their compromised physiologies and reserves. We know that illness may present in ways that are different from younger adults, but we also know they have pain, as you have so eloquently described. For the non-geriatrician providing care for these residents, where do we start in addressing pain management? How do we assess appropriately the elder in the long-term care setting? Do we resort to the World Health Organization, WHO, ladder? Or do we just start low and go slow? What's a good beginning strategy for pain management in this population?
Well, I think the World Health Organization ladder is a disaster, and it's unfortunate it was never intended for our population, and people should just take it back to their office, use it for other people. It's an important consideration in third world countries, but this is not really quality medical care. And the World Health Organization didn't really intend it to be, for our kind of setting. Start low, go slow has some elements of that are correct, but probably the first place to start is actually to go back and get a pain history from the patient, because when we're dealing in the long stay population, most of these are patients who have had pain for an extended period of time before they came to us. But often that history of that disappears, particularly as the bulk of our patients get admitted to us out of the hospital, where a lot of that history is gone. So nobody tells the doctor in the emergency room about what they were doing for pain, and it doesn't get conveyed to us in the transfer information, even from conscientious hospitals that are trying to give you good information. And then it sort of disappears into a vacuum. I would be extremely dubious of any admission who came who did not have some pain medication that they were taking periodically listed on their admission orders. There is the occasional person, who may be the exception to that rule, but the vast majority of people are used to taking things. In addition to that, many patients have been using non-pharmacologic approaches to pain, and we have tended to really downgrade those in the nursing home as valuable modalities for us, which don't appear anywhere in World Health Organization criteria, but which are very important for the comfort of a lot of patients. And if you think about what people actually do for themselves at home, the number of patients who have ice packs, who have hot water bottles, heating pads, hydrocolators, all sorts of different heat and cold modalities, who use liniment. I was astounded the first time I admitted a patient to a nursing home, and they said, well, and of course I use Tiger Balm twice a day. I'm going, Tiger Balm? You know, what is Tiger Balm? I mean, and they looked at me like I was a lunatic. I mean, everybody in the Chinese community used Tiger Balm, you know, when they had a sore shoulder or a sore knee. It was like, you know, how could I, supposedly a specialist in palliative care, not know anything about liniments? I mean, these are commonly used, safe approaches to medicine. I mean, and certainly the topical anti-inflammatories, the aspirin creams and some of those sorts of preparations are also very much available modalities, widely used in the general community as well. And they should be just part of our routine armamentarium. It's difficult often in our setting to get patients, particularly the heat and cold modalities that people would have normally used at home. You know, nursing staff wants to know exactly what temperature, for how long, you know, under what circumstances, et cetera, where, you know, our patients in the past would have simply said, you know, well, when I'm achy, I put on a heating pad and I use it for, you know, for 15 minutes or whatever. You know, we need, unfortunately, if nursing staff is going to be doing it, we need some relatively precise orders, but we can get that information from patients and their families fairly readily, and we really should start with what worked for the patient before. Mm. You know, I mean, this is the essence of person-centered care, and it just simply makes sense that the patient says, well, you know, this worked for me before. Unless there's some major contraindication, we would want to look to try to use that again. Going beyond that, we have a lot of available other modalities in the nursing home that people could be using, but which we haven't always thought about in that sense. I mean, for example, you know, your rehab department, physical therapy, probably could give you a lot of assistance with patients who have low back pain. We know that exercise regimens for that are probably more effective than medication, and that there's a lot to be done with everything from ultrasound and DP to a wide variety of different stretching modalities that can give patients a great deal of pain, both acute pains and chronic pains, that they could get some help from with a lot of those different things.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support the future of PALTC by remembering the foundation in your will or trust. Email Christine Ewing at CEWING@PALTCFoundation.org for more information. Thank you.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Nichols about the opioid crisis and its effect on skilled nursing care. Dr. Nichols, on the other side of the post-acute care coin, in a 2017 British Medical Journal article looking at prescribing patterns after surgery, the author found that the duration of the opioid prescription in opioid-naive patients was associated with misuse. In our post-acute care setting, the level of acuity in admitted patients continues to rise, and one can see that there is an association between levels of acuity and degrees of pain. We know that the minimum data set is capturing this information, and we know that quality metrics are looking at readmissions and presentations back to the emergency room. How do we approach the patient discharge from the acute setting when it comes to pain management, especially that patient who may only be in our care for 2 to 3 weeks? Do we need to view these patients differently than we would the long-term care resident that you just described?
Well, certainly we do, because these are patients who do not have chronic pain, generally speaking. These are acute pain patients, and the things that you're going to look for in terms of giving pain relief are still going to have some overlaps with the others, but are going to have some special concerns here. In addition to that, we're anticipating that these patients are going to have some significant fluctuations in their level of pain. So you're really talking about a series of kind of peaks and valleys. In the first peak, you're dealing with the immediate post-operative pain, you know, generally speaking. These are patients who've been operated on, but sometimes even with compression fractures or pelvic fractures that are not operated on, there's going to be an acute pain period. That pain period, however, is going to be a matter of a couple of days. Then there's going to be a reduction in that level of pain. Then they're going to come into our facility and we're going to say, get up and walk on that. And all of a sudden, there's going to be more pain, which you would expect. The patient should have an increase in pain if they're participating in your rehab program to the level that you would want them to. So you're going to need to match that pain so that they're not going to limit their activity based on pain avoidance. Then, after they've been with you for a few more days, that level of pain should also decrease as their muscle strength increases, as their bones knit, as things settle into place, and so on, and there should be another decrease. So, it's really a varying thing. By the time they're ready for discharge, their pain levels should be relatively low. And a patient who is begging you for continued narcotics after discharge is a genuine problem, because either you have not adequately dealt with whatever was their underlying problem, or you're beginning to face someone who's who's developing an addiction or dependency kind of problem that needs to be addressed. So we should be tapering people off prior to discharge, and the amount of medication that they're going to need after discharge should be pretty minimal for most patients. Again, length of stay varies a little bit from facility to facility, but if we're dealing with the typical 20-day period for your Medicare patient, you should be expecting that their pain levels will have been significantly reduced before they go home and should continue to decrease after discharge, so that the period of time that you're going to be requiring opioid assistance should be pretty limited and the quantities should be relatively small. Again, different patients have different problems, different settings, and so on, but we should not be giving people a 30-day supply of medication thinking that we're dealing with acute pain. Now, it may be that they have a chronic pain syndrome and that opioids are indeed an appropriate treatment for that, which sometimes they are. But that's not the patient, the typical orthopedic surgery patient who we're seeing. It is worrisome to look at not just that study, but others, about the use of opioids in patients who've had back surgery, which we still see a considerable number of in the nursing home, who are then still taking opioids 6 months after they had their back surgery. Either that was unsuccessful surgery, or we have really not done the right job in managing their pain. But certainly these are patients who should be triggering our concern that we have not adequately approached the needs of those particular patients and be very suspicious of exactly what's happening there.
But the other point that I think you're making is that the skilled nursing facility setting doesn't operate in a vacuum. And we still have the ability to reach out to specialists and say, hey, your patient is still having pain. Is there a piece missing that we need to be thinking about or that you need to reassess in this patient?
Exactly. So, I mean, if a patient has had surgery to correct spinal stenosis and they're not getting significant pain relief from that after a couple of weeks of ambulation, whatever, you would worry, was this unsuccessful surgery? Is there a bone chip left in there that's pinching and that's pressing on a nerve? Is there a surgical complication that's conceivably a low-grade post-operative infection or something that's not being adequately addressed? So you'd really be concerned as to what was happening with that patient and why this was happening. So yes, we're in terms of our collaboration with the rest of the healthcare system, we would be concerned either about a patient who'd been in the hospital a long time and whose pain is still very severe, or a patient who is coming through us and not getting the pain relief that we would expect. I mean, the major success for joint replacement is normally the pain control. I mean, mobility improvement is secondary to the pain control. If patients had a total joint replacement and they're not getting pain relief, this is should be a major source of worry. And then we look at a variety of different things that could be going on, which cover both the orthopedic and neurologic possibilities of the origin of the pain, not the least of which are patients who have their knee operated on when the problem was really their hip, but the knee pain was referred pain, but also depression, a wide variety of other conditions that could be complicating the picture.
So the skilled nursing facility can be the gatekeeper for reducing the risk of opioid dependence, which I think is a very positive comment for the role of the skilled nursing setting.
Arrogantly put in here, the reality is that the best of geriatric care in the United States is available in skilled nursing facilities. We are the only place where you can speak directly to the physical therapist who's working with your patient, you can speak directly with the social worker who understands what the home situation is, where you can really put all these different things together, where the nurses can tell you how much pain people are having when they're assisting them out of bed and so on, and where the available knowledge base for taking care of patients really resides. So yes, I think we can serve that purpose, but more than that, if it's not going to happen with us, it's not going to happen anyplace else.
Yeah.
So yes, people should very much be looking at that.
Dr. Nichols, as has become my custom, in the time we have remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you. We still hear the term death panels. We hear that hospice care is meant to hasten death. We hear that the use of opioids at the end of life is more harmful than good. And of course, most of the time we're hearing these things from families, but sometimes we hear them from our own colleagues. What is the truth about opioids at the end of life? How can we promote education about providing quality to patients and residents with life-determining illnesses? How can we change the conceptions about opioids to help benefit those in our communities who really do need them?
I think that this has been one of the most destructive side effects of the whole just say no movement. To ban a whole category of drugs or to be worried about a category of drugs, which like a lot of other things that we do in medicine, have advantages and disadvantages based on the clinical situation. As a person with a lot of experience in taking care of hospice patients, I know that there are a significant group of people who will actually live a great deal longer on the hospice program. The program was never designed to shorten people's life expectancy. And in fact, there's now data that lung cancer patients who go on the hospice live longer than patients who don't. It's to avoid the unnecessary treatments and concentrate on the patient's goals. Now, for some patients, pain relief is going to be a significant goal. And when you can achieve that, the patient is actually going to do much better. So if the patient is eating minimally, moving around their apartment or their room in the nursing home minimally because they're in terrible pain, and not getting the rest and relief that they need, those are going to be patients who are going to do very badly, and giving them pain relief is going to certainly significantly improve that, to the point that we in hospice frequently talk about the hospice honeymoon, which is that patients who get off of the stuff that they didn't need and onto the adequate symptom control suddenly bloom, and the reason that you put them on hospice because they were losing weight and losing function and all the rest of that begins to go away, and you say, was I really wrong? Was this person not really terminally ill? When in fact what you're really seeing is the superimposed burden of things that were unnecessary limiting the patient. Unfortunately, it's also the case that there are some hospices that reflexively want everybody to be on morphine, and that's just bad care. Morphine and other opioids have a significant role in various different situations. They're wonderful for pain control as one modality. They are, they're terrific for cancer pain, particularly because there's really no ceiling. You can go up as high as you need to get people the pain relief that they need, as opposed to virtually every other pain medicine, which has maximum possible doses. And they're, of course, wonderful for the shortness of breath that some patients experience in the last couple of hours to days of their life. But there's certainly lots of patients with advanced dementia who have no pain and no particular relevant symptoms do not need morphine orders, as part of their treatment. And the notion that somehow you have help that patient by getting them access to opioids is obviously crazy. So, those are patients who did not need that medication to begin with. Giving people unnecessary medications is bad. You know, I mean, just to be as simple about all this as we can. So not to be afraid of it when patients need it, and not to use it when patients don't. That doesn't seem so complicated.
We have been fortunate to hear the wisdom of Dr. Jeff Nichols around reconciling the opioid crisis with treating post-acute patients and long-term care residents who have pain. Dr. Nichols, thank you for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
Thank you for asking.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.